Okay, so the technology is running. So, for those of you that have never met me before, I'm Lewis Weiss, and I'm in the Department of Medicine and in the Division of Infectious Diseases, and I'm also in the Department of Pathology in the Division of Tropical Medicine and Parasitology, or Geographic Medicine, whatever term you prefer. And what they've asked me to talk about is basically the returning traveler, and in particular the evaluation of problems in the returning traveler with a focus on fever. So the first thing we can sort of say and think about in the returning traveler is, what should we do? You know, people travel all over the place. Is it reasonable to screen people when they return? Should they be screened? And if they should be screened, what should they be screened for and why? So in terms of travel medicine centers, and there is such a thing as people who make their living giving travel counseling, usually associated with things like executive health programs and wellness centers and what have you, in the service business or occupational medicine physicians who do a significant amount of travel medicine, screening can actually represent a significant portion of time. It's undertaken or should be undertaken to detect specific conditions and or risks that have health implications of travel. And essentially, much like anything else, there are sort of three things. And the first one is to assess the risk. Has this been long-term or short-term travel? And there are different risks with each. You know, business travelers or people who are going for 2 or 3 day trips to major cities in most parts of the world are not terribly exposed to just about anything. You know, someone going to Bangkok who's sitting in an air-conditioned room, you know, negotiating the price of widgets is not the same as someone who's going on safari somewhere out to see animals for 2 or 3 weeks, or roughing it, or hiking through the Malayan Peninsula, or things like that. So you sort of have to sort of look at the category, look at whether it's long or short term. And then a very useful thing is to sort of assess the activities that the person has done. And this really has to do with assessing risk. Have they been out around and by animals, bit up? Have they been in the rural areas? Have they had water sport contact? Have they gone on a river for some reason, which raises a whole risk of exposure to pathogens, and in particular for a good part of the world raises the risk of schistosomiasis exposure. And there's been a lot of cases of schistosomiasis occurring after travelers, including recreational travelers who go on, for example, whitewater rafting trips in exotic locations. So it's something you should keep in the back of your mind for fever in a traveler, or even neurological presentations for atypical schistosomiasis occurring up to a year after travel in someone who's had significant water exposure. Physical exam and diagnostic testing. So all that's kind of straightforward. But what really is worth doing? Well, this is basically what I would say is the base of what screening for a traveler. Someone comes back to you and says, I've been traveling. I'm worried I might have picked something up. What should I have done? Well, you look healthy to me. Maybe you should go home. But if you're going to screen, these are the three biggers. The one that's usually neglected is STDs. And I want to sort of bring it up as the first one because people do go overseas and have sex. My God, what a concept. But it's true, and people forget, particularly young travelers, but it's any age people go overseas. And there are even people who travel specifically to have sex. So you really do need to take a sexual history from your travelers and get an idea of the sexual exposure and risk for several reasons. And this just goes to show you in recurrence. Hepatitis B, which is considered a sexually transmitted disease, 11 per 100 person years in missionaries. That's for every sort of 100 years putting together lots of people with 11 cases. That's really quite a high incidence of hepatitis B. Peace Corps workers, when surveyed, only 32% used condoms for sexual experiences overseas. And we all know that HIV is endemic to many parts of the world, including the United States. Chlamydia, hep B, gonorrhea, and syphilis are all heavily transmitted, and some of these are drug resistant. So it really does pertain to taking the screening of a traveler and to doing the routine care in terms of this sort of screening. Parasitic diseases. This is usually why people come to you, because they're afraid of acquiring something exotic. And it is reasonable. There is a reasonable amount of exposure overseas. There's a reasonable amount of exposure in the United States. But overall, 4 to 10% of travelers have acquired some sort of parasitic infection when you look at different surveys, depending upon the length of travel. The screening that's probably most useful is stool ovum parasite. A series of 3 stool ovum parasites picks up approximately 95% of parasitic infections that one acquires. And most of the time, what's detected on this is pretty mild, asymptomatic carriage of amoeba, Giardia, sometimes worms, which is probably the most common things people pick up, things like ascarids. Specific serology is indicated for specific exposures. And I mentioned particularly the issue of water exposure, and that's one you should walk away with and keep in your head. People who've had significant water exposure overseas in schistosoma or bilharzia endemic regions, those are two of the same words for the same disease, have a reasonable risk of acquiring schisto, either having acute Katayama fever, which occurs during the initial acquisition of the disease as an FUO, but more worrisome coming down with manifestations later, particularly ectopic locations for eggs. And this has been reported in Peace Corps workers and medical students who are two well-studied groups of travelers. Not that they're a particular risk of doing things elsewhere. They just happen to have very good follow-up of large numbers. And when they've looked at these, there have been atypical neurological presentations of schistosomiasis in these groups, particularly schistosoma hematobium acquisition. And these people have come in with Brown-Séquard syndrome, that is acute cord disease, or they've come in with seizures and similar things from the eggs being where they're normally not supposed to be. And it can only be one or two worms when you have that. So this is diagnosed, while classically you look for the adult eggs in the stool for Schistosoma mansoni and japonicum, or in the urine for Schistosoma hematobium, you can actually diagnose this easily by serology, and particularly in these cases where it may be ectopic. That's really the earliest and easiest way to pick up these people in screening. In general, blood smears and filarial serologies are not useful in asymptomatic patients. This comes up relatively often. Oh, did I get malaria overseas? Well, do you have a fever? If you don't have a fever, we're not likely to find malaria. There's no reason to look for it. Filaria is pretty much the same thing. People do worry more about this, but we don't screen with filarial serology because unless you're symptomatic, I'm not sure there's anything we're going to do. However, routine CBC is probably the only other test that's reasonably useful. Eosinophilia is what we usually look for. However, I will point out that finding that eosinophilia only has a positive predictive value of about 14% for finding a subsequent parasitic disease or etiology of significance. So this is basically your screening tests that, well, there we go.
Question?
Go ahead.
Yes.
Well, actually, that's a very sophisticated question. You can actually do three samples on the same stool and pretty much reduplicate doing three independent stools because the finding of the parasites for most times is an issue of sampling distribution, not usually an issue of intermittent excretion. All right. There are some exceptions, a few parasites which are intermittent excreting, and then on a second stool it may be higher, and if you really look, there's a different number. So what we usually say is three successive days. But it could be three stools every other day. It could be three stools over 3 weeks. It really doesn't matter. The point is three samples or three examinations generally yields in that range. If a parasite is present, you'll only miss it 1 in 20 times. And that's considered reasonable. You can keep going up. Go to 6, you'll only miss 1 in 100 times. Go up to 99% distribution and so on. It's an asymptotic curve like most sampling from, most sampling distributions. Very hard to reach 100% of everything. But, the more you sample, the closer you get. But most people think 3 and getting up to 95, 96% is quite a reasonable exclusion. Now, this isn't for someone who's symptomatic. Someone who's symptomatic, who has diarrhea, and you've done three stools and they're negative, and you take a clinical history, and you think, well, maybe they really have Giardia because they've been exposed to water or they've been camping or something. There are other tests that one can add to routine stools to bring the sensitivity up higher, things like adding a Giardial antigen on the stool, which is a direct detection of the antigen of the parasite, or things like doing monoclonal antibody staining on the stool, as opposed to routine stools to detect Giardia. So there are some situations where you may do some additional special tests, but I was just covering essentially routine screening. So that's the issue of screening, and I'm not going to talk about it anymore. Now we're going to talk about what really sort of happens in terms of symptoms, and the first thing and the most important thing to remember is fever in the return traveler. And these are really the three key points. If you walk away from this with nothing else, please walk away from this. That fever in a traveler must be evaluated promptly, as a delay in diagnosis can have significant consequences, the development of cerebral malaria, spread of contagious diseases. And I will show you a slide later that shows who dies from traveler's malaria and why. And the most common reason that people die is misdiagnosis. They never thought of it. Never looked. Right? Within normal limits. WNL. We never looked. A key question for anybody who comes in who you see with fever, particularly in an urban environment, but really anywhere, besides, you know, how long have you had the fever and so on, is have you traveled or where have you been? Have you been out of the country at any point in the last 6 months? You can ask it in the last year. You know, malaria can occur as far out as 3 or 4 years from travel for vivax or ovalli malaria, which relapse from the liver, but particularly for falciparum malaria, which can be the most dangerous and most rapidly progressive, generally occurs within 3 months, most commonly occurs within weeks, if not a week of your travel, but certainly it can occur out. And so you really should find out if someone's been out of the country. And remember this last point. Just because someone has traveled, it doesn't mean they have an exotic disease. So, why do I put that up? Well, here's a list of two studies that were done. Reasonable number of patients, 587, 195 patients. And this is the diagnosis at the end of their evaluations for why they had fever. And you can see why you always think of malaria. 32% in one, 42% in the other. It is clearly a common cause of fever in a traveler. Notice that about a quarter of them are undiagnosed. There is never an explanation for the fevers. They often resolve spontaneously. Patient may be ill for a week or two, and you never quite get a diagnostic answer. Many of those are viral diseases of varying sorts where we just don't extend the diagnostic to the common cold or to whatever virus is circulating in an area or other sort of things. Tropical diseases, what people always sort of worry about, all the other sort of stuff, diarrheal pathogens, enteric fever, salmonellosis, rickettsia, amoebic liver abscesses, yes, they're there. Yes, they should be thought of. Yes, you should evaluate their presence. But realize that they're about 10% of the population. So the vast majority of patients you evaluate are actually not going to have a tropical illness, excluding malaria, which about a third of them will for that fever. But the majority of them will actually turn out to have things that you'd probably find in the emergency room here in your non-travelers. Hepatitis, respiratory diseases, pneumonias, UTIs, mono, tuberculosis, pharyngitis, meningitis, acute HIV infection. Remember I told you about sexually transmitted diseases. And then this miscellaneous, which sort of goes the gamut of sort of everything else, includes things like lymphomas presenting in the setting in tumors, which do indeed sometimes present in travelers. So we're going to focus a little bit on malaria. Why? I just showed you. Quarter of all people. How do you make the diagnosis and who gets it? First comment, no prophylaxis equals malaria. We have trouble reaching some populations in terms of getting them prophylaxis for their travel, primarily people who are returning to country of origin. So as we said, friends visiting relatives. These people will come in often for their kids, many of whom have been born in the States because they're worried about their kids getting malaria, but they often will not seek care for themselves or prophylaxis for themselves. They grew up with malaria. They got through it. Malaria is viewed as a relatively common, relatively benign disease. And many of these people who are expats returning to country of origin don't realize that the little bit of immunity they've gained to malaria over the years from constant exposure in an endemic region wanes rapidly once you leave an endemic region. So, you know, kids in malarious regions get severe malaria. Children die. It's a very common cause of childhood mortality. They get coma. They get algid malaria, severe malaria. Those that survive, not just malaria, but people in general in highly endemic or holoendemic regions who survive through their childhood and get treated for their malaria and survive, build up an immunity so that their subsequent attacks, while work loss and economic loss clearly is attributable to malaria in adults, they tend not to present with as severe disease because they have this sort of built-up hyperimmune response to malaria and they control it a little bit better. Within 2 years of leaving an endemic region, you behave like a naive host. These people can come back with severe malaria, cerebral malaria, and so on. If you look at people who, amongst those people, 25% who have malaria, about 85% in the Canadian series, 97% of those people who presented with malaria from being travelers had not taken prophylaxis. about 5% or so had taken mefloquine as prophylaxis. Does this mean mefloquine doesn't work? No, it's just to point out the other point, which is while no prophylaxis equals malaria, prophylaxis is not 100% either. You know, you can take prophylaxis and still come in with malaria, so it should still be on your differential, but it should drop down the list. If someone's clearly taken all their prophylaxis religiously, not thrown it up, yes, they could still come in with an attack of malaria. You should look for other causes as well, but it's still there. But no prophylaxis, high up. Who dies? No chemotherapy. 100% died. Delay in seeking care, missed by MD-13, lab misdiagnosis, missed therapy. This is just from 1999, just giving you an idea of the patients. So it just goes to show you, if you think of it, diagnose it, and treat it, the patients do reasonably well. Some patients die with malaria. The vast majority, over 98%, survive. Right? It's those patients who get sent out of the emergency room with viral illness, who get sent out of the emergency room with a different diagnosis, URI, what have you, who then go home because no one asked if they traveled, who come back with coma, cerebral malaria, who really are the ones who get sick and really die. So what are the common causes? We talked about this. Let's talk about the differential a bit. Malaria, respiratory tract, diarrhea, hepatitis, UTI, dengue, enteric fever, rickettsial, infectious monopharyngitis. Just to bring you the list again, right? Just to go over it so you sort of put in your mind, got someone who's traveled, what should be high on my list? Where should I be going for evaluation? Does that mean that's everything? No, there's clearly rarer things. But this is sort of the big one. If you can remember most of this list, you will diagnose clearly over 90% of patients who come with tropical travel fever. Can we improve this? Yes. Now, you won't be able to read this slide very well. I'm going to show you another one that's a little bit better. But you have copies of all these slides. I gave them. So you can sort of look through them for review. One of the other things you can sort of look at is incubation periods, location. This is going to help you decide, you know, whether they've been exposed to anything. We can simplify this a little bit by saying, okay, when did you get your fever? So you come back, you've traveled from the tropics, you've traveled from this, you've gotten your fever. How long have you had it? When did you get it? I just got it. I've had it for 7 days. Well, that's an acute fever. Rapidly developed, undifferentiated, less than 14 days from the travel. So you're developing it rapidly after leaving an endemic region. And these are sort of the group of things that one should think of that sort of present rapidly. Again, the top of the list, malaria. Okay? Then probably second on the list, dengue as a viral illness. And I'll show you a little bit about that later. Highly characteristic presentation. We can't do much except for supportive care, but it's really holoendemic in the world, and you should really think of it in your travelers. And then the rickettsial group. Why should we think of it? Because tetracycline is rapidly effective, and people who have been out, particularly in the bush, or looking at the animals, or hunting, or recreational activity, much like going to Soundview State Park in the Bronx, where we've got rickettsia, and we've got Rocky Mountain spotted fever being endemic. If you go out into the bush in many other parts of the world, you can pick up other rickettsial diseases, and you'll present. And on physical exam, you look for the eschar, you look for the rash, and they respond nicely to tetracycline. And then you get into the diarrheal illnesses like typhoid, which should always be on your list. How about if you go a little bit further out? Can we change this? Well, let's say I'm 2 to 6 months out from when I've traveled, and I happen to have come in now, and I said, well, I traveled, but can't be anything due to my travel. It was 4 months ago. I was in Asia. Could I still have acquired something from my travel? You still cannot throw malaria off your list, you know, at 2 to 3 months, going out to 6 weeks. Malaria can still present. Remember, the life cycle of malaria is you get bit by a mosquito. It goes into your liver. It then replicates in your liver. It breaks out of your liver, and it's changing its life cycle at this point, into your bloodstream, and then cycles through your blood as a different life cycle. So when it goes into the liver, it can take a while before it goes out to the liver, infects the blood, and then it takes a couple of replicative cycles in the blood until it begins to build up so enough blood cells are infected that you really start to manifest fever, and you start to feel poorly. So it can be a while. Now, falciparum malaria and malaria do not rest in the liver. But vivax and ovalimalaria, two of the species that infect humans, can actually go into the liver, and when they replicate there, they can sort of stop replicating and form essentially a resting form or a cyst, what's called a hypnagogite. And they can sit there for up to 2 years before they then break down and complete their life cycle. Right? The nice thing is those malaria cases are less severe. Vivax and Ovalle have fever, but they don't tend to go on rapidly to develop coma. Those malaria parasites don't bind to endothelial cells. They don't bind to the capillary system, so usually have more time to make the diagnosis. But again, but you notice what starts to come out when you start to get out to a month is schistosomiasis, leptospirosis, amoebic liver abscesses, hepatitis, and there's your typhoid. So again, length of duration can sometimes help in terms of telling this. And then once you start to get out to really, you know, several months, they use 6 weeks. Again, now tuberculosis now begins to rise up on the list. So now here, when patients have been out of an endemic region for a long time, start to think TB, bring your hepatitis cases up to the list. Again, your leishmaniasis, more visceral. So some of these more chronic diseases. So how can we conceptualize this? If you're going to conceptualize it, think intracellular pathogens and intracellular protozoa are the things that come up late. So you've got intracellular, you know, tuberculosis. You've got these intracellular leishmanians. So the others are more focal parasites. And that's a way to conceptualize it. Notice that the viruses are not here. Dengue is not here. So if patient's been out for two months, they're not going to present with dengue. What else can we do in assessing our patients? One of the other things we can sort of assess in these travelers to help us with diagnosis is what they've been exposed to. And I've talked about this, the recreation, the animals, ingestion of foods, part of the history. These are the pathogens. You can look at this for yourself. You know, people don't carry this in their head terribly well, but it is useful if people tell you, I've, for example, gone out and I sort of ate all the street food I could get. It sort of tells you their risk of exposure. I went out and I ate every bit of ceviche. I love seafood. I ate drunken crab, which is just crab in essentially pickled in a little bit of wine in Asia. This is basically another type of sushi derivative and so on. And it brings up risk. Well, if someone says that, one of the first things that I usually ask is, did you get a hepatitis A shot before you traveled? Because if you're eating raw food and you're eating raw fish, even if you're going to Japan, hell, even if you're going to City Island and having oysters, and you haven't had a hep A shot, that's one of the things I'm going to think of when you're coming in with your fever. And, of course, the screening tests that you get, the routine laboratories, are going to help in that. So let's get to basics. That's the background. That's the history. What are we going to do? The patients come here. What should be the routine? This is the routine. Every patient, fever and travel. Complete blood count with manual differential. Thick and thin blood smears, serum electrolytes, liver profile, urine analysis, blood culture, stool for ovum parasites, culture and fecal leukocytes, and chest x-ray. Every patient with fever who's traveled. From this, you can usually get to a differential diagnosis that'll get you most of the initial things that we've talked about. Now, if the patient has pharyngitis and lymphadenopathy, you can add on to this a monospot. If the patient has liver function test abnormalities on this and right upper quadrant tenderness, patient should automatically get a hepatitis panel. If the patient has anemia, thrombocytopenia, blah, 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 one can start to go into coagulation panels. One should really start to think about malaria. One could even start to think about really rare stuff like Ebola fever if they're really manifesting a septic picture. But this is just the routine on everybody. So you get a blood smear, and this is what you see. So what is it? What do you see? You should be able to recognize this. Shall we start on one side or the other? Does everyone see the same thing on both sides? What's on this side? Well, why don't we start with where is it? Are we talking about a blood smear, a stool smear, a respiratory secretion? Blood smear. Great. Both sides, blood smears, red blood cells. White blood cells. Excellent. Remember, I'm in a pathology department. I know these things. So this side, what do you see? Well, that's probably a platelet. But what's that? 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 little things inside red blood cells with a little red part, a little delicate ring, and then a little blue below it, right? And what you look at here, one of the things you see when you look at this is there aren't two things in red blood cells like there are on this side or one. There are multiple things within red blood cells, and there are multiple red blood cells infected. So like you said, this is plasmodium. These are ring forms of plasmodium, and this is a very heavily parasitized blood smear that is very worrisome, that this patient is going to need to go into the unit and may actually develop severe hemolysis. If you see something like this with very delicate rings, and particularly if there are multiple rings, like two in the same red blood cell, you should think plasmodium falciparum. Severe malaria. Almost all falciparum malaria is chloroquine resistant. So you can't send the patient out on chloroquine. You have to treat them with other things. Quinine is an oral drug. Quinidine is an intravenous drug. But even more so than that, in this country, these patients should be admitted if you think it's malaria. And if you're not sure the species of malaria, always treat or always think it's falciparum. Now, what's the difference between here and here? What's different about these from side to side? These are bigger, right? I mean, these are very delicate and little. These are bigger and round a little bit. And, you know, the rings are quite large. This is actually kind of a smeared red blood cell. You can see it's almost got a teardrop shape. But do you notice anything weird about the red blood cells that these things are in? They got little dots all over them, don't they? Can you not see that? Is it really hard to see out there? Someone flip off the lights for 1 second in the back. Can you see the dots now? Little dots? No? All right. Well, turn on the lights. I tried. I can see them. There are lots of little tiny dots there. Those are Schuffner's dots. All right? Again, if you don't know, you treat the patient as if they have falciparum malaria. But hopefully, if you the difference between these two, and you don't need to know how to speciate malaria, is if you could look at this and say, well, this is like falciparum malaria. This looks weird. It doesn't look delicate. It looks like they're big, they're amoeboid, and there are lots of little dots in here. This is probably malaria non-falciparum. If you can make that distinction, and if you feel comfortable, these are the cases you can treat with chloroquine. This happens to be ovale, but that's okay with the Schuffner's dots. This just shows you what falciparum malaria looks like, and I'm just showing you here to show these very delicate rings. You never see all of these forms over here because they're all stuck in the capillaries. This is why falciparum malaria is so bad. It sticks to the capillaries and one gets severe disease. You do see in people who have had this disease for over 7 days or people who are semi-immune, you do see gametocytes, which are what go into the mosquito and transmit it through the mosquito. And these look like bananas, but you usually don't see them in people coming in with acute malaria. What? Which? These? You see them in the blood. All this is red blood cells. Everything here can be found in a red blood cell. You just don't see these life stages normally because they're stuck to capillaries. As opposed to, say, here, ovale malaria, here you see it's much bigger. There are all those little dots here. But you see all these forms that develop. You actually, if you look carefully around in ovale or in vivax malaria or malaria, you will see all of these forms in the blood. So when you start to see a lot of weird things in the blood, other than just little rings, right, that's when you can think it's something else. Now, take home. This is good. And you, if you can make this distinction, it's wonderful. If you can't, you always default to treating as if it's chloroquine-resistant falciparum malaria. Because that's the one that, if it's not treated, can be rapidly fatal. The others will respond to the drugs for chloroquine-resistant falciparum malaria. P. malariae, P. vivax, P. ovale. They're not the drugs of choice, but they will respond. And in 24 hours or 12 hours, when the smear is reviewed by someone who's perhaps a little bit more expert, you can always shift the therapy over to chloroquine as opposed to using quinine or quinidine. So this is just to show you asked about this a minute ago. Here's one of those bananas in the blood. This is a falciparum gametocyte. That's what it looks like. Pretty nondistinct, but it certainly doesn't look like something you're used to seeing in the blood. This is that smear again, just showing all those ring stages. This is just to give you an idea. P. malariae, again, something in the blood, but it doesn't look like a ring. It's kind of weird. It's in a red blood cell smeared straight across, a band form. Some rosettes or merozoites. This is getting ready to break out and reinvade the blood, but you see it looks very different than little rings. Here's more Schuffner's dots, another form. And you get the idea that there are different sort of life stages going on. Here's ovale again, and you can see here these big amoeboid. This doesn't look like a little delicate ring, just to give you an idea for this. What? They're pigment deposition from breakdown products in the red blood cells. And why falciparum doesn't form them, I don't know. Probably, I don't know. That's what I'm just going to say. I just don't know why you don't see them, because they all break down things. Now, I'm putting this up. It's kind of like a boards type question, because it's been in the news a little bit. And I just want you to realize that there is now a fifth species of malaria that's known to infect humans. And this has been described mostly in Oceania islands. And it was recognized in a funny sort of way. People thought that there was a lot of P. malariae on some of these islands. Yet it seemed to have a different course. P. malariae is usually a very benign malaria. It's the sort of thing that goes chronic and people can have it for 40 years. You know, sort of low grade and doesn't even bother them until they get to have a decreased immune system and they get to be 80 years old or someone gives them steroids and all of a sudden they get a relapse of malaria 40 years from when they had their original malaria because they were never treated. This is the story of, you know, that used to be the old British, you know, army people who served in the British Raj in India and, you know, oh, my malaria is attacking me, I'm 82, you know. And these are also the people who get, you know, nephrotic syndrome from malaria because of chronic antigenic stimulation and they come in with, you know, nephropathies. But in this part of Oceania, it would look like malaria, but people were getting really sick and they were dying and, you know, it just looked strange. And it turned out when people finally did the genetics, even though it looks very much like malaria, you have these band forms and all these other things, it turned out that it's Plasmodium knowlesi, and it's actually known for a long time to be in monkeys. So it's a monkey malaria which can cross over into people, another zoonotic disease. I'm just mentioning it because it is possible it'll show up somewhere on a boards question in passing because it's one of these things that have been in the New England Journal and what have you. And also just to show you that there are sometimes some cases that look like malaria of non-falciparum that actually behave badly, and some of them turn out to be zoonotic malaria in particular, this monkey malaria, which has now been described. It responds, by the way, to standard antimalarials. And then the final thing that you might see in a traveler, and they come in. So, again, red blood cells. What do you see? Excellent. I heard someone from the back. Why do you think this is babesia? It does look like malaria, except it doesn't have a ring, right? There are no rings. Go ahead. This is a classic Maltese cross. This actually appears on the boards all the time, and I know because I gave him this slide. And this is a Maltese cross. This is actually hamster blood, but don't tell them that. There's another one, by the way, over here, just on the... No one knows that one is there. This is actually does not have a little hole in it. All right? Does not have a hole in it. So it's not a ring form. It's actually kind of like a comma or like a pear-shaped little organism. And you can see them all over the place. And occasionally you may see things that look like rings. But you can find these very characteristic sort of tetrads, these Maltese cross forms. The story for this would be someone who traveled, but this would be a traveler who didn't necessarily leave the country. They might have gone out to Fire Island. They might have gone up to Nantucket. They could have gone any place where there's Oxodes ticks, like Westchester County, Connecticut, Old Lyme, and they come with their fever, and splenectomies in particular get really severe disease here. But this is our sort of United States version of malaria. You do find, by the way, babesia, though, in other parts of the world. So babesia is in Europe, babesia is in Japan, so travelers do occasionally come back with it. I'm just pointing out to show you that not every ring form, not everything that's in the blood is necessarily malaria. However, still go back to the old-fashioned idea. The default is what? As if chloroquine-resistant falciparum malaria, if you think that you're seeing anything in the blood that could be malaria. and actually would work for Babesia, quinine and clindamycin, right, which was used in Weiler Hospital on a baby where they thought had falciparum malaria, was the first demonstration of an effective anti-Babesia therapy and became the standard therapy for babesiosis. All right? And we now know that that is a good therapy for it, and the alternative is azithromycin and etovacone, which would now a lot of people would consider a drug of choice because it's a little easier tolerated. For babesia. Okay, so where do you find malaria? You find malaria everywhere. All right, and that's really all I want you to bring up from here. Come on, there we go. Treatment we talked about. Chloroquine sensitive, all species get chloroquine. Vivex and Ovalle malaria go into the liver, right? So they can rest in the liver. Chloroquine does not kill liver stages. That's the reason why we give everybody who's got Vivex and Ovalle malaria primaquine. Okay? Everybody else gets quinine with usually a second drug, usually tetracycline or clinda. Mefloquine or etovacone, proguanil, or artemisinin are all alternative effective therapies that are used in different parts of the world. Severe malaria gets IV quinidine. It's probably one of the only reasons quinidine is still around.
Why do we have to spare the blood if they can thin smears?
To try and get an IV, well, it depends. Initially, you do thick and thin smears because if the parasitemia is a very low density, the thin smear may be negative, but you'll see the organism on the thick smear. If you can see it on the thin smear, there's really no reason to examine the thick because you can get the percent parasitemia on the thin. The other thing that you should be aware of is there are diagnostics that are coming along that are available for malaria that don't depend on smears. And they are available. We do have them here. But they're not in like the emergency department or in a way where you can get them 24 hours necessarily. They're dipstick technologies that look for malarial histones or other malarial antigens. They can diagnose falciparum malaria, and sometimes some of the tests will also diagnose Vivax or Ovalle malaria. And you basically take some blood, you lyse it, you drop the dipstick into it. It's kind of like a pregnancy test. The band comes up, and it says, oh, malaria, P. falciparum, or P. vivax, based on whether the band is there. They're nice, rapid screening tests. They're good in the sense that they don't require any expertise in terms of morphology. They give you no idea about parasitemia, so they don't tell you necessarily how sick the person is, other than clinically. And they don't detect P. malaria and some of the other stuff. But they're very useful and widely used in some places. Clinically, one of the other things I should mention that sometimes is useful in terms of your routine CBC for detecting the malaria in your malaria in your travelers is thrombocytopenia. So a patient who comes in with a fever, history of travel, and they comes back, their CBC looks normal, but they've got a thrombocytopenia like 50 or 60,000 for no good reason. You really need to think malaria, because the reason is because falciparum malaria decreases the platelet count, either from damage to the endothelial cells and platelet direct effects on platelet by sort of little microplugs, or directly by affecting genesis of platelets. The other thing you should think of when you see thrombocytopenia in your CBCs with a fever? Okay, and one last. I actually was surprised all of you got dengue. Rickettsial illnesses. Flu-like illnesses, fever, nonspecific, thrombocytopenia. Rickettsial illnesses because they're endothelial pathogens. So platelets adhere to the endothelium. So, you know, when you've got a flu-like illness in the spring, when flu doesn't occur, and they come into the ED, and they've got thrombocytopenia, you really have to think Ehrlichia or Rickettsia, you know, these sort of illnesses. Travelers, too. This is just the treatment. Forget about that. We don't need to talk about that. This is a fine point. I just want to bring it up because you guys deserve fine points. You're residents. You're not medical students anymore. So there is resistance to Vivax. I told you chloroquine was the drug of choice. But in fact, in Indonesia, Oceania, some South and Central America, there is resistance reported. And so you should be aware that even in these other malaria cases, when you treat them with you expect them to do well, you put them on chloroquine. If the patient is not doing well a few days later, one of the things you should think of is resistance. And the other thing you should think of? What? A second diagnosis. And the most common second diagnosis, because you can get more than one tropical illness, would be dengue or typhoid fever. And we've seen many patients with malaria who come in who just don't seem to get better, and we send off then dengue serologies, and lo and behold, they're seropositive for dengue, or we manage to get stool or blood cultures, and lo and behold, they turn up to have salmonella in their blood, and we treated their malaria, but they're still febrile and not doing well because they've picked up a second pathogen on travel. So you have to always think that there could be something. You expect your malaria cases to get steadily better once you start therapy. We talked about the treatment of this. So what about this? So we've taken this off, so what else? So now we go to specialized tests. We talked about the general tests. What specialized tests? So this is pretty straightforward. You know, lumbar puncture is indicated for any instance of altered mental status or suspected meningoencephalitis, even arboviral diseases, right? The usual stuff being sent. The travel-related business here is trypanosomiasis, which is often on the boards. I don't know why. There's only been one travel case that I'm really aware of in North America, and it seems to appear all the time. But it is a risk factor, acquired trypanosomiasis, African sleeping sickness, which is from the bite of the tsetse fly. Sexual activity we talked about. Then if there's any liver things, liver ultrasound, MRI, brain, spinal cord, if there's focal neurological disease. So this is pretty obvious. This is trypanosomiasis. I want to show it to you because, again, it appears on the boards. It's useful to remember. Patients who have altered mental status, change in personality after travel, sometimes fever. If you look in the blood or in the CSF, you can sometimes see trypanosomes, and that's what a trypanosome looks like. In this case, this is an African trypanosome with looks a little different than the ones from South America, which cause a different disease. And if you happen to catch someone who's early, they may have these big bug bites on them, and this is the bites that you get from tsetse flies. This is from a tropical medicine book, not from anybody around here. So this is just to show you these nasty sort of insect bite lesions from the tsetse fly. So we mentioned the next one that you should think of. So really, on a practical sense, when you've got fever in a traveler, you should think of viral diseases. This is a list of viral diseases. It's very hard to remember all of them. Usually you open, say, where have you been? And then you can open a book and look to see what's there. The one out of all of them, however, you should take a memory of is dengue, because it's ubiquitous. So how does a dengue case present? Who here has seen a dengue case? Got a whole bunch, all right. So you guys are experts. You've seen one. How does a patient with dengue present, other than their fever and a traveler? Right. Well, if they have a rash, so some patients complain of a rash. Not everybody presents with a rash, but they can. I heard headache, which is indeed often a symptom, although that's more, it's associated with a lot of fever. Pain behind the eyes, and then bone pain. You know, one of the names for dengue is breakbone fever. All right. So, sort of intense bone pains. You see that in flu, too, although not bone. People in flu often complain about leg pains for no clear reason. But all the things you're talking about, retrobulbar eye pain, a rash which comes and goes, thrombocytopenia on the CBC as a subtle laboratory finding, sometimes a mild hepatitis on the CBC, complaints of severe back pain or severe bone pain. These are things that should lead you down to the idea. You still look for malaria, but should lead you down to the idea that this could be dengue. And how do you diagnose dengue? Serology. IgM serology, seroconversion. We don't have an antigen test. It's a virus. We don't cultivate this virus in the laboratory. So it's suspicion, diagnosis by serology, and the therapy is supportive. Now, dengue can be quite severe. If you get exposed to serial types of dengue, all right, you can develop hemorrhagic fever. With dengue, a hemorrhagic dengue fever. And at that point, you start to bleed. Again, it's supportive care, but it's a coagulopathy. I don't think we've ever seen a case of that in Jacoby that I'm aware of. But it is something that appears. This gives you an idea of the distribution of dengue. Little things for 1960, and then you can see where it's expanded to. And it's even actually further than this. This is old. These areas which have Aedes aegypti and also the Asian tiger mosquito as well, also now have dengue. So Caribbean Basin, parts of Texas, little parts of Louisiana, so you don't have to travel necessarily outside the United States, which is why it's always useful to ask where you've been, not just outside the U.S. You know, all throughout here, Mexico, Brazil, most of Southeast Asia, a good deal of Africa. So basically, just throw it into your differential for anybody with fever who's left, who hasn't traveled north. Okay, so that finishes sort of the discussion of general presentations. You know, fever. You know, I've come back, I've traveled, I have a fever. So what about other travelers? So some travelers do come back with other manifestations. And skin disease is in return traveler. Systemic illness with skin disease. I just don't feel well, I have a lesion. So we can divide these into several of the normal. Petechial or hemorrhagic, rickettsial, dengue, leptospirosis, hemorrhagic fevers. Diffuse diseases, rat bite fever, measles, brucellosis, focal, things like Lyme, syphilis, trypanosomiasis. So, hemorrhagic lesion. Young kid, multiple lesion, hemorrhagic. Diagnose it as petechiae. How? Doesn't blanch when you press down on it with a slide. Grab a slide, press hard. If it doesn't blanch, there's blood under the skin. That implies what? Well, it doesn't imply Rocky Mountain spotted fever. This happens to be a case because there's a dermacentor tick, although there is an eschar there, and usually with Rocky Mountain spotted fever, you don't see them. But and then you're right. This is a Rocky Mountain spotted fever case. This is a child from Jacoby from 15 years ago, when I was a young fellow. ID fellow, not just a young fellow. But what I meant is it's petechial damage. Petechia is defined as a non-blanching rash because essentially blood is leaked out of a capillary bed. If blood is leaked out of a capillary bed, it implies what? There's damage to the endothelium. If there's damage to the endothelium, it's a pathogen that infects the endothelial cells. Hence, rickettsia comes up relatively high for a petechial rash because it's a primary endothelial pathogen. And then this just shows what an eschar looks like. In a traveler, you might see something much milder than this with eschars, for example. There've been a whole range of reports of people who go in Africa to the game parks or to either hunt with a camera. Nowadays, very few people hunt with guns as commonly, but going off safari hunting with cameras, and they come back with febrile illnesses and usually five or six little ulcers on them and occasionally a few petechiae here and there. And what they've been bit by is either R. acari or R. conneri, which are the African ticks. Those are the rickettsia that the African ticks carry. And the African ticks that are present, you know, throughout South Africa and sort of that area where people go to surveys, they're very aggressive. They kind of like travel in packs. Usually you get like one tick bite, but in this case you get like five or six tick bites at a time from being in the grass. And you come back with these febrile illnesses. It's important to remember because these are exquisitely responsive to tetracycline. When these patients come in really sick, they look horrible, they have high fevers, you know, put them on tetracycline. 24, 48 hours later, they're ready to leave. I mean, it's a remarkable thing, the response of rickettsias to tetracyclines. So what about pruritic skin lesions in return travelers? Now, this is, again, not a major ED problem of acute response. You're not going to care if someone's got an itchy rash that they need to be started on antimalarials or way that they're going to be dead in the morning. In general, unless you're developing angioedema or, you know, progressing to, you know, a real sort of overwhelming hive reaction, most of these are at the level of, if you would say, annoyances. But this just gives you an idea of the list of pruritic skin lesions in the return traveler. And you can see that we have all of the sort of arthropod infections, chiggers, fleas, lice, mosquitoes, scabies from bites, very common drug sensitivity reactions and affect sea bather's eruption, which is essentially from either sea lice or from jellyfish exposure and stings, and phytodermatitis. I'm going to show you this in 1 minute because I got referred a case of that recently. And then the old thing, swimmer's itch from schistosomes that are avian, that is bird schistosomes, cutaneous larval migrans, which is probably one of the most common things, and then all sort of the others. So the ones you should really sort of be able to recognize at a moment's notice, this is one. I've come back from a trip. I was laying on the beach. I was happy as a clam. And, you know, I got back, and I have the most itchy thing. I'm itching every day. I can't stop scratching. It bothers me like you would not believe what is going on. So what is going on? These are two people with the same story. And these are uninfected, so neither of these have developed cellulitis. But these are really common to develop streptococcal cellulitis because people scratch so intensely. This is one of the most pruritic lesions you can get. What do you see? What do you think? Well, all right, so you all have the diagnosis. And you can see here, it looks like there's a track that goes up, right? And another track over here. And this person who was sunbathing on the beach, and we asked, took off the top, laid down, get a nice tan on the back, sunbathing on the beach. And you can see here right around, long linear lesions. How does this happen? Besides bad luck. What is it? Said cutaneous larva migrans. Person to person? That's often the question, right? People say, am I going to give this to my husband? Am I going to give it to my boyfriend? Am I going to give it to my kids? Are they? No. Why not? What is it? Is it a human pathogen? No. It's a zoonotic disease. It's actually an accidental host that's gotten into. It's cat or dog. Parasites, in this case, hookworms, Toxocara cataea canis, excuse me, go ahead. No, can't complete its life cycle, and scratch what I just said about Toxocara. I said it right. It's getting late in the day. Toxocara cataea here. You cannot give it to your pets because it cannot complete the life cycle. So what you've got here is you've got a filarial larva which has migrated into your skin to attempt to complete its life cycle. So it's going to migrate through your, if you were the right species, it would migrate through the skin, go into your bloodstream, go up to your lungs, get coughed up, swallowed, and complete its life cycle in your gut. Okay, they're very complicated, but that's the way these things, that's the way, you know, if you were to get exposed to hookworm, that's how you get hookworm into your gut. Doesn't get brought to you by an insect. It actually goes through that very funny migration straight through your lungs, breaking out. Strongyloides does the same thing. In this case, these cannot complete their life cycle because they just don't know. They're in the wrong host. They don't know what's going on. And they're getting attacked by the immune system as they migrate. And they're very antigenic. That's why it itches, because they're really recognized as major foreign invaders. And so all this inflammation is because of all those worm antigens. And that's one of the reasons why they itch so much. You can treat this by giving topical freezing therapy, or you can give systemic therapy with thiobendazole or albendazole to kill these larvae. So here's a 25-year-old female who returned from a trip to Jamaica. She spent a lot of time on the beach. She presents one day after return with a linear eruption on her leg. She remembers seeing both dogs and cats on the beach, and there's the eruption. So, good story, right? Cutaneous larva migrans, linear eruption, right? On the beach, one day after being on the beach, it's okay. What's wrong with the story? She was referred to me for treatment for cutaneous larva migrans. What's missing in the story? Itch. No itch. Really bothers you that there's no itch. Bothered me on the phone. But I said, sure, send her. You know, she's worried. You know, she's been told she has a parasite. She was freaking out that she was going to give it to her kids. Fine. Come and see me. So this is the front. This is the back. Still no itching. So, the answer's over here, those of you that can read fast. But I asked her, were you on the sun in the beach? Of course. Did you have any drinks when you were on the beach? Yeah. Did you have lime in your drinks when you were on the beach? Oh, yeah, I love lime. So, this is phytodermatitis. And these are little drips from her drink that she had on the last day, dripping down her leg. From the lime peel. She photosensitized her son from Sorulins in lime. You can find it in limes and a bunch of other things, but lime's the real big offender for people who travel to these nice tropical places on the beach and what have you. And so you should just be aware that this is the mimic of cutaneous larva migrans. And like the person in the back said, the lack of itching is usually the key. The other thing is that these lesions are flat. They're just hyperpigmented because they're essentially a localized sunburn. So they tend to be flat and just a little hyperpigmented. And they fade with time. And they did. She didn't need albendazole. This is just to show you what, you know, some people do come back with other things. This is a little flea embedded under the skin. It's a tunga flea, itched underneath. And this was a 16-year-old girl who traveled to camp up here in Rhode Island who had a pimple that developed, and the mother touched the pimple and it moved. So she freaked out a little bit. I think I would freak out a little bit too if it was my kid. So you can see here there's a little puncta in the middle of this pimple, and this is a screw fly. It's a type of fly that lays eggs on the flesh of animals. The maggots dig in and they eat, and then they pop out and pupate in the ground. It's just nasty, but it's real, and you should know it exists. Yeah, this was... That wasn't Jacoby. Okay, so let's see what time it is. I think I have a few more. Do you guys mind if we go a little longer, or you want me to stop? Up to you. Go? More gross stuff? Okay, more gross stuff. So ulcerative skin lesions in the returning traveler. Here's a long list of lots of stuff that people can come back with, and a little bit of the differential of how to define them. You know, anthrax, hemorrhagic surrounding edema, non-painful, right? Leishmaniasis, painless, rolled edge, chronic. Syphilis, painless, genital within duration, so on and so forth. So, you know, you can go through all of these sort of things. They sort of help you. What should you remember? The one in red. Ulcerative skin lesion in the returning traveler from the tropics. You should immediately in your mind, this is the differential. Please try and look it up or think about it. But the first thing in your mind, clang association, leishmaniasis. All right? Doesn't mean it's the only thing. But it should immediately come to mind. You should always think, if I've got someone who's traveled to the tropics and they've got an ulcerative skin lesion, I should make sure they have an acquired cutaneous leishmaniasis in their travel. So here's your case presentation. And this was a case in Jacoby last year, I guess it is now. It's been almost a year. 14-year-old born in Ecuador, traveled here by boat and car. He noted a papule in Mexico, which enlarged, ulcerated, and grew over the next 2 to 3 weeks. The ulcer was painless and remained. Physical examination was normal, except the ulcer with rolled borders and the lymphadenopathy up the arms. So to give you an idea, this is when he presented to the emergency department. Nice, big, red, beefy ulcer. And you look in this ulcer, and if you look, you can sort of see there. This is courtesy of Chris Coyle. I think she took these pictures, but this is a case we saw. You can see the lymphadenopathy sort of ascending, what we call sporotrichoid presentation. Sporotrichosis is a classic infectious disease, rose handler's disease, where you get sort of punctured by working in the soil. You get injected with a dimorphic fungi, and then it goes up the lymphatic, causing little nodules as it goes up your lymphatic train. So sporotrichoid lesions is where the name comes from. So this is a case of leishmaniasis proven by biopsy. You treat these with the appropriate therapy. They do well. Just to show you, these are real things that happen to lots of travelers. Here's a kid, very nice young 16-year-old from Scarsdale, was she? I think it was from Scarsdale. Somewhere up in Westchester, lots of money. Parents were both lawyers. Made people nervous. Who came in with this lesion on her cheek. After having been treated by her primary physician and then by a referral infectious disease person with various antibiotics for an ulcer. She had gone on a trip to somewhere in, I'm trying to remember, is it Panama? I think it was Panama. It was somewhere in approximately that part of the world, in Latin America. It was a school trip for about 2 weeks. They had been on the beach mostly, and yet she came back with this. And actually, surprisingly, one other child in her group actually had non-healing ulcer as well. She also subsequently had one of these when you carefully looked. And then when you biopsied her, you could see that there were tiny little lesions in the skin and little parasites within the lesions, and she had leishmaniasis that was missed by her physicians, and she had been treated with oral antibiotics for chronic ulcers for approximately 3 months. She responded extremely well to pentostam therapy, which is the drug of choice. She healed up nicely. She ended up with a little bit of a scar there, and it became a major issue, basically because she wanted to have plastic surgery before her prom. And you really shouldn't cut through these lesions because you can reactivate the leishmaniasis. And we managed to finally convince the family that, well, maybe a little cover mark makeup is a better idea than plastic surgery for the scar on the face. But nonetheless, I put these up as cases to illustrate, right, that you should think of leishmaniasis, ulcers from the tropics, and that it's very common to miss them. It is true. People come in with pyoderma. They come in with Mycobacterium ulcerans. There are other diseases that cause ulcers, but you really have to remember the leishmaniasis and not miss that diagnosis. So two more cases, and I'll be done. 30-year-old Mexican who immigrates to the U.S. in 1998. He returns from Mexico from a one-month trip and returned 2 months ago. So we're talking, right, 8 weeks from travel. Presents with fever, abdominal pain. He denies the history of prior fever. So in the emergency room, he had 103, but he said he wasn't having fever at home. Physical, had right upper quadrant tenderness, normocytic anemia, no eosinophilia, and elevated alk phosphatase. Anyone got an idea of diagnosis? Salmonella is a reasonable one. But again, I told you the evaluation would be to do liver functions, right? And then the next test you would order, blood culture is very reasonable. You might order a hepatitis panel, because we talked about it, although someone who was born in Mexico unlikely to have hep A, but maybe they acquired hep B or hep C acutely, or leptospirosis, right? But the next step would be imaging. In this case, it was a CT. You could have done an ultrasound. This was the CT. What do you think now? Amoebiasis. Do an amoebic serology. That confirmed the presence of amoebiasis. The patient responded very nice to metronidazole. Let me show you a Chinese girl who traveled to China and actually bought some metronidazole when she was in China, but it was unclear whether or not she took it, presented with fever and dysentery symptoms, was diagnosed as ulcerative colitis. It's reasonable. Young girl, dilated colon, right? Bloody stool, high fevers. Negative for all the other things. This woman turned out on colectomy to have amoeba all throughout her colon. She was given steroids, got worse, got sort of a megacolon, became an acute surgical case, took it out, and there were amoeba through it out. So I put this up in travelers to remind you that amoeba does cause dysentery in travelers as well as amoebiasis, and that when you see an inflammatory bowel-like presentation in someone who's traveled, even in someone who, quite frankly, who's not traveled, you should do your best to exclude amoebiasis before one goes and puts them on steroids, and certainly before one goes and does a colectomy. Yes? I'm trying to remember. I think they might have done one, but they never did a serology. You can ask Chris Coyle. She was involved in the case. She gave me this slide, and I actually couldn't get a hold of her today to get the history, to put the history up. That's why it's up here without a history. It's put here up as a case, a teaching case of travelers and what have you, really to sort of bring up the point. But ask Chris, she'll tell you all the details of the case because it's her case. So, should we do one last case and then we'll call it a day? Or you want me to stop? All right, I'm going to read this because it's very long. This is a Charlie Neuer case. A 26-year-old woman from the Dominican Republic was well on arrival to the United States in late February of 1997. 1 month later, she presented to the local hospital, which was here, complaining of several hours of severe, sharp right upper quadrant pain radiating to the right shoulder with fever and chills. She denied a history of gallstones, jaundice, use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or oral contraceptives, recent trauma. On admission, her temperature was normal. She had mild right upper quadrant tenderness without hepatosplenomegaly or masses, was negative pregnancy test. She had eosinophilia to 27%. CT scan demonstrated a necrotic mass in the right lobe of the liver, which extended from the dome to the inferior border laterally to the capsule, contained internal septations with parenchymal hemorrhage. An IgG enzyme immunoassay for echinococcus was low positive. The patient was transferred to our institution for further management. And this is what she's got. So she was transferred from the management for echinococcus, right? Which she doesn't have. I'm going to tell you that right now. This is not echinococcus. This is kind of a necrotic-looking lesion, almost like an abscess with little bits, but it's not a well-defined cystic lesion with septations. We repeated the echinococcal serology here on transfer. It was negative in our hands. So, Dominican Republic, liver lesion, traveler, fever. What else would you like to do? What other histories would you like to take? And, of course, you're standing in front of a parasitologist, so. Well, they did an amoebic serology. It was negative. They did stools. They were negative.
STD?
What STD? What STD causes holes in the liver? They did do blood cultures because they thought maybe this was a liver abscess that had been missed, and all the blood cultures were negative and all of that. The Strongyloides doesn't do this. They didn't actually do that. But they did ask a very interesting question. So she denied exposure to farm animals, dogs, or fresh water, other family members. She had no liver tenderness. So remember, she has a very high eosinophilia. What does high eosinophilia signify? Often parasites, right? Neoplasms, parasites, right? Atopy, allergy, collagen vascular disease. Kind of a broad differential, but those are sort of the big ones, right? Eosinophils, still up at 31%, ALKFOS 127, review of CT revealed the inconsistent, no capsule, hemorrhage within the cavity, repeat unchanged. Amoebic serology, Western blot, echinococcus negative, stool specimens, no pathogens. The following week, her eosinophilia went up to 7,000, 46%, and then started to decline. Is there any other question you might want to ask? And people did, and it's a dietary question. Well, I hear the diagnosis, but I haven't heard the question yet. So someone's reading their boards books. What? She doesn't eat raw meat. She doesn't eat seafood, you know, other than normal sort of cooked stuff. There's no cerveci. But what she does eat is berro, which is watercress. She loves watercress. She ate it all over the place when someone finally figured out what the right term was to ask her in Spanish. And berro is a classic thing on which one finds the transmission of fasciolopsis. And indeed, serum tested negatives for fasciola hepatica adhere on presentation. However, IFA tests for antibodies performed on serum chain 1 and 2 weeks after the negative revealed rising titers, and this was done over in Paris. And an immunoelectrophoresis test was positive as well. So this was a case, and this is a case referred here. Again, Charlie Neuer was involved. I took this directly out of the publication of the case. This was a Jacoby case. And she was treated with a single dose of triclibendazole, which is the drug of choice. This shows the CT healing. And these immature flukes, basically what they do is they burrow around, they penetrate through the capsule, they cause an intense amount of necrosis and hemorrhage and liver disease and eosinophilia as they burrow through the liver, heading for the bile ducts where they eventually want to live. So that's the reason why she presented when she did. She had acquired it, it was penetrating, it was digging its way through the liver, going to its final resting place. And this was a traveler who presented with a liver abscess and marked eosinophilia, turned out to have fasciolopsis. And I'm just going to ignore, well, here, I'll show you this one real quick. Well, maybe I won't. See if I can get to it. I just want to show you the last. See, can I go the other way? No, this one doesn't work that way. It's not like a Mac. Sorry about that. There we go. So I'm just going to show you. This is a guy who came in with pulmonary disease after getting steroids, fever, strongyloides is what he had. Again, no one screened him before they gave him steroids. He had chronic strongyloidiasis. He got abdominal pain after he got his steroids, presented rapidly with diffuse pulmonary disease. And surprisingly, this was a Montefiore case. This is what the smear looked like that was sent to the laboratory, the plate, the culture of his, quote, pneumonia. It's gram negatives, but what's really kind of cool here is, look at this, that was developing on the plate. This was picked up by the technician who looked at the plate. And what this is on the plate where the gram negatives are, where the where there's pneumonia that he was getting on top of everything else. This is the migrating worms that were in the sputum that were on the plate, and so you could see the worm tracks in the culture plate. And that's a very classic image that I've seen reproduced elsewhere, similar sorts of things, of migrating worm tracks. So that's it. This was Travelers. I hope it was kind of fun at least, and I hope you picked up a couple of things. So I'm done. Slides to look at. I have no problem with it. However, I don't contain the rights to any of these slides. Fine. Just as long as people can't download them. Or you put them in a form. I would prefer it be a PDF, to tell you the truth. So that you can look at them, you can download the PDF, but you can't take the slides and use the slides in other presentations.
And I can save a PowerPoint in a way that I can make it a PDF form?
Yeah. You basically print it. I'll show you how to do it. I'll show you on PowerPoint. This is the way.
I want to bring up your presentation.
I'll show you how to do it. It's really easy. The only reason is because I don't own the copyright to these slides. Many of them are Chris's slides, and she's very particular about who has her slides.
Here we go.
And so what you do is you do